From the studios at Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudet. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News, Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Brian Clark, opinion writer at the Idaho Statesman. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Howdy.
So, Dawn, I want to start with, I have to say, one of the strangest stories that we've heard in a while. Can you talk about a gun charge against a man from Greenleaf who apparently wrote Boise Mayor Lauren McClain's name on one of his bullets?
Yeah, so I'll say a couple things. First of all, Boise Dev does not, in general, cover crime. Yeah. And nor do I lead your program very often. but we have been looking into this for quite a while. There is a man from Greenleaf by the name of Eric Erlin. He was sentenced in federal court on Monday. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel was there in the courtroom. And the U.S. attorney called him a radicalized extremist. And his charges really don't relate directly to Boise's mayor. He was charged ostensibly for unlawfully possessing firearms and an assault against a U.S. Forest Service officer. The U.S. attorney and the FBI said that he had vandalized some Forest Service campgrounds. The reason it became a story for us is we put a particular focus on covering Boise and its municipal politics. And starting last fall, we had been working on understanding why the city of Boise had started to scale back putting information about officials' travel on the city council agenda. This is something that came out of the reforms after former Mayor Boise Mayor Brent Coles was drummed out of office for doing some extensive travel around the country that the public found to be problematic. So there's kind of the scene set here. In the materials that the FBI says it found when it took Erlin into custody were a series of bullets. And we have these words unbleeped in our story. I won't say it on the radio, but one had Die McClain written on it. One had F Feds and another had F BLM. The federal prosecutor says that they believe that BLM in this instance stood for Black Lives Matter, although obviously you could understand why some might think it said Bureau of Land Management, especially mm-hmm. since he was arrested for vandalizing Forest Service property. And he also, there was some writings and some notes where he had a page that said, mask up, Idafornia, disrupt operations, disrupt sympathizers, defend homeland. And one of them on this page said, McClain, who's got your six? And I don't have a military a background. Both my grandfathers served, but I didn't. And I didn't know what that meant. But Margaret mm-hmm. Carmel, who does have a military family, basically said that that implies, you know, watch your back. And so it was some fairly extensive information here. And also some ties to a group that he calls, or that he referenced as SAI in his notes, which is known as the Sovereign. I apologize here because I can't spell Sovereign, but essentially a supremacist group. And so it's kind of this really complicated tale, Sovereign Alliance of Idaho. And the defense for Erlin essentially said, and pushed back on some of the things from the U.S. attorney and the FBI and said that he was suffering from some mental illness, that he's not the kind of person that would even generally possess guns. He had claimed that he had been blackmailed to carry these weapons. But the scene set, I think the level set here is that in March, Boise Mayor McClain came out with a statement that we actually didn't cover at the time. And the reason is because we weren't able to put any context to it, and the mayor wouldn't answer questions. But the gist of the statement sort of said that she'd been facing some fairly significant threats. And I'm going to read just a little bit from it. Mm-hmm. And this is from March. She said, "It's incredibly difficult to talk about the more sinister, thwarted plots and serious threats I've received because it makes it more real, as if it's happening all over again. And as I write this, I once again see the briefings, the photos of perpetrators and evidence, my kids' faces, my husband's fear." And so that's kind of this complicated story that has the mayor as one component of many.
Okay. I appreciate all the background on that, Dawn, because as you said, it isn't something that normally Boise Dev covers. Kevin, I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about schools because we're getting ready for schools to go back in session. And we have rising concerns about COVID-19 here in Idaho, yet you wrote yesterday about how, in spite of this new variant, Idaho's biggest school districts aren't changing course.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what Boise will do officially. Trustees are going to take it up on Monday, but their plans for COVID protocols seem very similar to what we had last spring when Boise lifted its mask mandate. I think that was in March. Nampa is not changing their course. West Ada is not changing their course. And, you know, as you say, it comes at a point where we have a new variant out there, the BA5 variant, and depending on what research you're looking at, it looks like it's a more contagious strain of COVID-19. It may be less severe. That's up for debate. But really no changes in terms of protocols and in terms of policies. And, I think a little bit about where we were a year ago. And we were in a very different place, obviously. You know, vaccines were just hitting, had just hit and were just starting to become available for kids. The Delta variant was a different animal, I guess, than BA5. But it felt like going into last fall, schools didn't really change much of anything until Delta really hit. And I kind of wonder, at this point, like I said, the largest districts in the state are pretty much staying the course. They say they're going to watch what happens with case numbers, with infection rates. We'll also watch and see what happens with CDC. Their guidelines could be changed any day now. CNN has reported that. I just looked on their website. I don't see anything new in the way of CDC guidelines. And again, guidelines, but CDC is saying that if you have high infection rates, like you have right now in Ada County, in Canyon County, they're still recommending masks indoors in schools. It's hard to see that happening politically going into another school year. I'm hard pressed to see Boise or West Ada going back to mask mandates unless things get really, really, really nasty. And Nampa, majority of the trustees ran on opposition to mask mandates. So I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah. Kelsey, before we go into a break, there's yet another wrinkle with former state representative Aaron Von Ellinger's rape conviction. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, this goes back to the last month or so. There's been talk of him filing a motion for a new trial or acquittal, and that has to be filed 2 weeks after the jury puts in its verdict. So he kind of gave the court notice that he had intended to appeal that conviction. And it was kind of up in the air whether the judge was going to grant it until last week. Well, it was 2 weeks ago. I don't even know anymore.
they all rolled together.
The sentencing was supposed to take place on July 28th. And the judge decided, you know, it would be more distressing for the victim in question to sentence him and then have this possibility of a new trial looming over everything. So he pushed the sentencing back. And the motion was required to be filed by the 3rd. And so he is basing a lot of it around testimony from the sexual assault nurse examiner who examined Jane Doe after the assault, and mostly saying that the state was leading the witness when they got her to talk about Jane Doe's statements regarding the portion of what happened that she said was rape. Without going into too graphic of details, they just said that there was insufficient evidence because the state led her into saying what the jury decided was rape, and they convicted him of that rape charge. So that's part of it. They're also saying that his Sixth Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution were violated because Jane Doe did not testify fully. She was there for about 10 minutes and said that she couldn't be on the stand and do that. And she left and the state couldn't get her back. And so there's the Sixth Amendment is about the right to confront the witnesses against you. But under Idaho law, there's no legal requirement for the person who is the victim in a situation to testify. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit up in the air as to whether that's going to be accepted by the judge. She was not there under subpoena. And when the judge asked Von Ellinger's attorney if he wanted to declare a mistrial or move for a mistrial, he said no. And so we'll see what the judge thinks of all that. And then I think the last piece that he had in his motion was that there was some new evidence from a sworn affidavit that is under seal right now saying that there are different claims about the night in question that Jane Doe made to somebody whose identity is unknown as of the moment. So The state has a opportunity to respond in a brief in the next couple of weeks, and then his hearing will be on the 25th to go through all of that new evidence and testimony. So,
Brian, we have been talking a lot this week about Idaho's abortion laws, as has many other news outlets, and you wrote an editorial. Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
Well, just to be clear, it's the board's editorial, not mine. But right. So the U.S. Department of Justice this week announced that it would be suing Idaho's trigger law, suing Idaho over its trigger law under a federal statute called EMTALA. This is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. It's a 1980s law governing. Basically, it made sure that hospitals would admit and give emergency care to anyone who showed up at their doors. And what the federal government is arguing, the Department of Justice, is that Idaho's law would in many cases stabilize what's called necessary stabilizing treatment under EMTALA, that many abortions in medical emergencies would fall under this statute. And so the argument is that federal law here preempts state law, and that therefore Idaho doesn't have a legal basis to enforce this law. Got statements from a variety of politicians on this. The governor said the U.S. Justice Department's interference with Idaho's pro-life law is another example of Biden overreaching yet again, while he continues to ignore issues that really should demand his attention, like crushing inflation and opening the border with Mexico. Raul Labrador said, in filing this lawsuit, the Biden administration seeks to replace the will of Idaho's citizens with President Biden's pro-abortion priorities. The common thread that we saw in many of these responses was that they're entirely political and contain no identifiable legal reasoning. They're completely vapid. Idaho has, in just this month, paid another third of $1 million out for lawsuits it's lost for unconstitutional laws it's passed. So this is looking like it could be more of the same.
Okay. And Dawn, talk a little bit about Intuit scaling back its physical offices.
Yeah, so Intuit is a fairly large software maker based in California. They purchased a company by the name of T-Sheets in the last decade. Right before the pandemic, I did a story that they sought out, noting mm-hmm. that they were going to occupy a new second building that was basically the size of the first building. Well, they're going to still occupy that building, but they're going to bail out of the first building. So instead of doubling their office space, essentially they're going to maintain the status quo. After I published the story, I heard from an Intuit spokesperson that wanted to emphasize that they're still committed to Idaho, and we didn't imply differently. The big change here is that the pandemic happened, and a lot of companies have shifted their approach towards who needs to work in an office, how often, and when. And so this story really is less about Intuit taking a step back in Idaho. They're still going to employ lots of people here. They've got lots of jobs listed, but people aren't going to be going into the office for them, at least for now, as often. And so instead of needing 130,000 square feet of space, they're going to need about 65,000. But for employees out there, the good news is they're going to get to move into a brand new building, even though the old building is only a few years old. But hey, you still get to move into some newer space. This story obviously is certainly about Intuit. But I think it's also one of those things where there will probably be more of this. We are definitely seeing a shift in the office market. I've actually got my eyes on a couple of other similar stories that we're working on. It doesn't mean that office space is going away. It's just that we're seeing changes. And this is one of those long-lasting economic impacts of the pandemic that will play out, frankly, probably over the next 10 years.
Oh, easily. Absolutely. And speaking of the pandemic, Kevin, I know that Boise State University is ramping up mental health services. I am assuming one of the reasons is what we have seen during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the story about a week ago. And what interests me about this is Boise State is adding counselors that they're adding. They're in the process of filling 5 mental health counseling positions on campus. And what I found really interesting about this is that it's being funded through student fees. Student leadership last year really made this a priority. So some of the fee increase that students are going to be paying next year is going towards hiring these 5 positions. I think it's about $600,000 to create these positions. And you're absolutely right, Gemma. When I spoke to Matt Neese, who is the head of the counseling department at Boise State, he said, you know, everything has intensified during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It's not just that we have more people looking for help. And that's a good thing. I mean, people are reaching out for help. The stigma about mental mm-hmm. health is starting to dissipate. But as more people are reaching out for help, they are in a more intense need for help. They're contemplating suicide. They're contemplating, they're just feeling much more isolated on campus. They're feeling much more more alone. They don't know who to reach out to in this very politicized environment, this very polarized environment. None of this, as he put it, is new. All of it is just more intensified. So I was really interested that this is something where student leaders and the university administration came together to create these positions. And they hope to have them filled, if not by the start of the school year, pretty close into the beginning of the school year.
Kelsey, Representative Simpson made 15 funding requests for state projects, and then he voted against them?
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's actually not an uncommon story from the Congress this past month either. Simpson actually sent out a press release highlighting all of those funding requests and showing all these things that were included in the appropriations bill that was passed by the House on July 20th. And 0 Republicans in the House actually voted for that bill. It just passed with Democratic support. And 106 of those Republicans put in funding requests. So he definitely was not the only one. This is pure speculation, but I think because the Democrats have a majority in the House, they just kind of voted against it symbolically. Or Simpson said that it was too expensive and he wanted to cut down the cost in conference later. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you look at it on its face. He was the only one of our 2 representatives to submit funding requests because Representative Fulcher, Russ Fulcher, does not believe in earmarks at all. And he's taken a pledge against requesting any of them. But they're pretty important projects. A lot of them have to do with water quality enhancement and education centers and fire stations and things out in Custer County really need some help because especially they've had a lot of earthquake damage from those earthquakes near Challis. And one of those is the courthouse annex building. It's not ADA compliant and it's pretty much degrading. So that got approved. And one of the ones that didn't get approved was the Mackey Dam out there, which was like $7 million that didn't get included in that bill. But There were just a lot of things in that bill that are pretty important to those communities, and we'll see if it passes the Senate, but it was kind of an interesting political game that those Republicans are playing in the House.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin, the president of the State Board of Education came out with some strong words against some organizations, including the Idaho Freedom Foundation and Reclaim Idaho.
Well, not yes. Kurt Liebeck, the president of the State Board, he was speaking this week at the Idaho School Administrators Annual Conference in Boise. And some of what he said wasn't really new or surprising. He's been very critical of folks who are pushing an anti-public education agenda. And he didn't mention the Freedom Foundation by name, but I think pretty much everybody in the room knew who he was referring to there. I found interesting his comments about Reclaim Idaho. He didn't really criticize Reclaim Idaho by name either, but what he said was, what he's concerned about with the initiative is that it forwards this narrative that Idaho is failing to fund public education. And his perspective, obviously, as a gubernatorial appointee, so take it with a grain of salt there, is that the legislature deserves credit the past couple of years for really trying to put more money into education. And there's no question that this year they put an 11% increase into the public schools budget. He said that the whole narrative about Reclaim and the initiative is a dangerous narrative because, like I say, he feels like it implies that the state is failing public education. So really interesting comments. And also interesting, he kind of called out administrators and said, you know, one thing you can really do to help change the dialogue is improve your reading scores. We, you know, the legislature put $72 million into literacy this year. We got to show a return on investment. That's what legislators are going to want to see now that they've put money into the system. So some pretty strong words.
Yeah, I mean, definitely strong words. And Don, I want to talk about this latest story about the folks behind the Wilder and Certified Kitchen and Bakery. These are restaurants and bakeries in Boise. Excuse me. And Don, I mean, they just keep expanding, but I think their reasoning behind it is certainly different than I think why we see a lot of other restaurants expand.
I'm exhausted because I got to do my books today and these people are opening a new restaurant every year.
I know.
Yeah. So I talk, running a business is hard. I mean, I'll just say that.
It's tough. Difficult. Yeah.
David Rex is, David Rex and Lizzie Rex are the principals behind Certified in the North End, the Wilder downtown, Roosevelt Market in the East End. And I ran stories on back-to-back days on their efforts, which is a little atypical, but because they were on different restaurants, it made sense. Next month, they're going to open something called Wild Child on Lata. And it's kind of meant as sort of a neighborhood restaurant and, you know, burgers and grain bowls and all sorts of stuff. And then they're also at work on a project that tentatively is called Percy Restaurant. This would go downtown in the new apartment building called Hearth. And this is a bit more of an ambitious effort. It's 5,000 square feet, which is a fairly significant size for a restaurant with a huge kitchen, large bar, patio space. So that's the backstory. But one of the things that he talked to me about is he's like, hey, you know what? We could just live within our means and raise our children. And he didn't say coast, but coast, essentially. Or we could open, you know, five different Wilders and do that. But he said, you know, we've got all these great people and we want to give them more opportunities. And so by opening more restaurant, it opens up things like a COO position or a director of marketing. And helps build some opportunity for people to move up and to grow and to have new opportunity. And so it is a little atypical and it is interesting, obviously. And as I was writing this story and kind of thinking about it back, I didn't ask him about the current challenges that a lot of service businesses are having with workers, which I actually really typically do. Didn't hear, but I think you can kind of read between the lines that like, hey, if we can provide more opportunity, it's a recruitment tool and helps us to create a system to grow people from, you know, soup to nuts, so to speak, in their career. So you're going to see those two. Again, the Wild Child will open next month and then the downtown restaurant next year. You can read a little bit more about what you'll find both of those on Boise Dev.
And my own little editorial, Certified makes a delicious egg sandwich. Just
Oh, the star chip cookie is amazing. So, and my wife and I
so love good.
Honey Badger. I feel like I'm advertising now, but I'm not.
I know, me too. They
didn't pay me to say it. I just
Honey
like
Badger
the food.
Is my
it's
favorite.
Yeah, oh, they're not paying me either. Trust me, I pay them every weekend. I want to thank all of you for coming on today. Big thanks to Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News. Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com. Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. And Brian Clark, opinion writer at the Idaho Statesman. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You too.
Thanks, you too.